From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm Ekta, I'm from Walnut Creek, and also from Thailand.
El Cerrito.
From Oakland.
From Albany, California.
Coming up, will San Franciscans vote to give grants to long-standing businesses?
If we can help Twitter, why shouldn't we help these mom-and-pop legacy businesses?
And why some small business owners are concerned.
I think favoritism is going to be the issue.
Then we'll find out why local monument makers dedicate themselves to setting the lives of our loved ones in stone.
And this is what you should see for a loved one, something that brings you back to the good times.
And we find out the answer to this week's audiograph mystery sound.
G, giving, garlic in our garden. A, acceptance, aromatic garlic ale.
We'll spell it out for you today on Cross Currents. Well, elections are just around the corner, and one of the propositions on next Tuesday's ballot aims to address San Francisco's affordable housing crisis. But the city's rising rents are also affecting local businesses, forcing closures of mainstays like the Lexington Club, San Francisco's last lesbian bar that closed in April after an 18-year run, or the 48-year-old Chinatown restaurant Empress of China that shut its doors for good last year. In answer to closures like these, Prop J proposes a legacy business preservation fund that would award annual grants to small businesses and nonprofits in San Francisco and to the landlords that house them. But in order to qualify, the businesses have to be 30 years or older and prove that they have, quote, contributed to the neighborhood's history. KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma went to find out how the city plans on assessing this and whether or not small business owners are on board.
The Roxy Theater sits on a frenzied corner on 16th and Valencia. In the cramped lobby, there's the familiar sights and smells of a movie theater, the faintly chemical scent of buttered popcorn, candy for days. But inside the theater, it's a little more unconventional.
In all candor, you and your husband are part of the 1%. How can you credibly represent yourself?
On screen isn't the latest big studio blockbuster with handsome movie stars. It's kind of the opposite, the most recent Democratic debate. The theater is packed with Bernie Sanders supporters who boo and cheer to signal their support.
And make every public college and university in this country tuition free.
Sanders' campaign has reserved the theater for tonight. That's because the Roxy Theater has been a nonprofit organization for 6 years. It can also be used as an event space.
It's extremely difficult to run an art house cinema for profit.
That's Tracy Wheeler. She's the president of the board of directors for the Roxy Theater, which has been around for 106 years. Recently, it faced an existential crisis that's becoming an increasingly familiar experience here in San Francisco. The lease was set to expire, and the Roxy didn't think it would be able to survive a considerable rise in rent.
The landlords, seeing the huge rise in rents in the Mission, felt that they no longer needed to be as concerned about it being a movie theater as we had hoped they would be, and were willing to open it up to the highest bidder.
In the end, the owners were able to extend their lease for another 3 years at the same rate through a hidden clause in their contract. But it definitely left a lasting effect.
So now what we're doing is sort of playing catch up and really trying to get back on the good foot because it really threw us.
If Proposition J were to pass, the Roxy and other qualifying legacy businesses could get $500 per year for every full-time employee. Not just that, their landlords would get $4.50 for every square foot of space they lease, if the landlords extend the lease to at least 10 years. But there's a cap. Any business that's eligible for the grant could get at most $50,000, and landlords would tap out at $22,500.
It says to landlords who have these legacy businesses who might feel on some levels like, wow, I bought a white elephant or inherited a white elephant, that the city cares about its white elephants, because I think it gets kind of lonely. And you think, well, why am I doing this?
The proposition would establish an initial $3 million fund for registered businesses. It would come out of the city's general fund. Right now, there are roughly 7,500 businesses that could qualify. A business has to be at least 30 years old, or 20 if they can prove that they're really in danger of closing. The Board of Supervisors voted to create a registry back in March. But as the list of legacy businesses grows, so will the size of the preservation fund. In his analysis, the city controller estimated that in 25 years, the cost of the fund could reach between $51 and $94 million.
Even though this program is in place, there is a lot of flexibility that the Board of Supervisors has. The Board of Supervisors could decide that this program is no longer needed.
That's Supervisor David Campos. He's one of Prop J's sponsors.
If we can help Twitter, why shouldn't we help these mom-and-pop legacy businesses that are going out of business?
Campos's district, which includes the Mission, Bernal Heights, and Portola, is home to the largest number of legacy businesses. He believes they're good investments. They hire employees who live in the neighborhood and create a sense of community for local residents. For Campos, this proposition also presents a rare setup.
And, you know, it's one of the few things that I've worked on where there seems to be pretty universal support.
He meets with the other supervisors. They all unanimously back the proposition. So does the SF Democratic Party and neighborhood associations like the Haight-Ashbury Neighborhood Council. But there are still some vocal dissenters. Here's Howard Epstein. He's the vice chair of media relations for the San Francisco Republican Party.
Just philosophically, the taxpayers should not be subsidizing for-profit businesses. And it's unfair to other businesses. They should sink or swim on their own.
The San Francisco Chronicle and the urban planning firm Spur both recommend voting no. Their main concern is the potential for political abuse. The only way to get on the list is if a supervisor or the mayor nominates your business. To them, this doesn't seem fair. Once you're on the list, the nomination has to be reviewed by the Small Business Commission. They'll evaluate whether the business has contributed to the neighborhood's history, which has got some business owners wondering, how do you quantify a thing like character?
There are three main folk art stores, Mexican folk art stores in the Mission.
That's Nancy Charaga.
24th and South Van Ness is Luz de Luna. Also at 24th and South Van Ness is Mixcuatl. And then Casa Bonampak, my store, here on Valencia Street.
Her store is full of fair trade imports made by artisans across Latin America. Right now, the store is stocked with elaborate decorations for the upcoming Dia de los Muertos celebrations.
I've been around for 19 years, so technically none of these three stores would apply for Prop J. But if you look at the character of the Mission without these three main folk art stores, what would the Mission be like without that representation of folk art culture?
She says she's going to vote for Prop J, but she has some concerns.
Definitely, I think favoritism is going to be the issue, you know, and so it's really about, is the business qualified and do they have significant contribution, or is it going to be about politics and what have you done for my campaign?
She wonders whether the money would be better put towards younger businesses that are less established and whether businesses will grow reliant on these subsidies.
I think a good rule of thumb for small businesses is we try our best to survive on our own. And that's really going to determine the healthiness of your business.
So with or without Prop J, Charaga will keep doing what she's been doing for almost 20 years, along with all the other small business owners here in San Francisco, working hard to try and stay afloat. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
Catch all of our November election coverage at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Small business owners around San Francisco come from many backgrounds, and that diversity that characterizes life in this area also holds true in death. Just ask local monument makers like Chris Vierhaus, who runs American Monumental in Colma. So how do local monument makers blend artistry with an understanding of the varied cultures here to capture the lives of our loved ones in stone? KLW's Melanie Young visited some to find out.
We do, you know, Armenian, a Persian percentage. There's Catholic. There's a Japanese cemetery up there where it's Japanese only. There are 4 Jewish cemeteries in town. You have to know how to do Cyrillic to engrave Asian, Korean. There's a Korean section.
So how do local monument makers blend artistry with an understanding of the varied cultures here to capture the lives of our loved ones in stone? KLW's Melanie Young visited some to find out.
Judy Leff stands in the early morning sun at the Hills of Eternity Jewish Cemetery in Colma. It's a beautiful park-like setting. The graves bear a mix of English and Hebrew inscriptions. Little stones rest on the tops of many of the memorials.
And that's a Jewish tradition. You put a stone on top of the grave to show I was here.
Leff lost her father, Henry, in 2007, and her mother, Sylvia, in 2010. But in some ways, they're still a part of her life.
I come out here all the time, just because I love the cemetery, and I miss my parents.
In their day, Leff's parents were well-known actors and educators, and when they passed, she was left to ask,
how do you say that in a stone?
That's a question many eventually face. When someone we love dies, how can a headstone express who they were? The answer begins with diamonds. Inside the American Monumental Company in Colma, foreman Richard Bortoli lowers a circular saw onto a slab of granite.
There's little diamond, really small diamonds in there.
Oh, because diamond is so hard,
yeah.
It can cut
yeah.
through the granite.
As he cuts, the stone begins to shimmer. He maneuvers a saw along a wooden pattern to create a custom top for the headstone. Chris Vierhaus, owner of American Monumental, says they have designs for everyone, practically.
As the Filipino and Latin American community has become more established in our area, you see a lot more, you know, Our Lady of Guadalupe's and the Virgin Mary's. The Asian designs are a lot of times it's the little bamboos and the little pagodas and phoenix and dragons.
Your house has kind of developed into a cultural anthropologist.
You learn a lot of different cultures. You learn a lot of different religions and hear a lot of stories here.
Sometimes he even knows more than his clients, so they turn to him for guidance.
I mean, many of the families, they're second generation. They're not aware of certain cultural or ethnic kind of things. Like, for instance, I've had a Mexican-American family come in here, and they really like this one cross. And I have to point out, you know what? That's a Celtic cross. I don't think that's the right cross for you, you know, because it looked really neat. But it's really an Irish Catholic cross. And then they go, wow, I wouldn't even have known that. You know, thanks.
Sometimes clients need help. But sometimes they yearn for what they already know. Art in Stone, another monument shop in Colma, started out by filling one culture's particular need.
The Russian Jewish community.
That's Michael Radar. His father Leon opened Art in Stone in the 80s, during a wave of Russian immigration.
They were accustomed to what they saw back in their homeland, and they didn't have anybody here to manufacture it for them.
Michael's father Leon learned his craft in the Soviet Union.
I came to work with artistry when I was 14 years old. Step by step, I learned working, drawing.
And what Leon Radar mastered was the very distinctive Russian style. If you go to the Russian section of the Jewish cemetery, it feels a little like you've entered a fairy tale. Huge granite sculptures rise up to represent the dead. Some take the form of a loved one's passion, a life-sized guitar or grand piano for a musician, a winding strip of film for a photographer. For many years, Radar also hand-etched images into granite. Much like creating a tattoo, he would use a needle and etch in each dot. The work was slow and painstaking, but he didn't mind.
Oh, I love it. When I work, I don't need food, I don't need water, I don't need anything. I'm just full in this work.
Today, Leon Radar's son, Michael, says computers have changed all that.
We have a different technique now. It's also etched in stone, but it's half computerized, half sandblasted.
In a way, the process transforms granite into a photographer's lens. Families can design much more intricate and realistic imagery for their loved ones.
This is what we did for a young kid. Used to race with his father, loved baseball, loved the Giants. And this is what you should see
for a loved one, something that brings you back to the good times.
So it's got him in his baseball gear and picture.
The boy beams out from under his baseball cap, the former Pac Bell Stadium behind him. To the right, he and his father sit astride a race car. They hold a winner's trophy. Monuments today can showcase both cultural traditions and the very personal. What's more, Radar says designing a monument can help families heal, but he says the timing needs to be right.
Actually, sometimes when I have families come in like directly after a funeral or within a week, I send them on their way. Because I'm a big believer, if you design a memorial when you're in grief, every time you're going to come back to that monument, you're going to come back to that grief, to that pain. So I always tell them, go home, come back in 6 months. 6 months, 7 months. You need to design this with a straight head, and then they're always happy with the final design.
Back at the Hills of Eternity Cemetery, Judy Leff says she took the time she needed to design her parents' monument. Performing was a huge part of her parents' lives.
So I put the Hollywood Walk of Fame signs on here, the comedy tragedy mask, the radio microphone, TV screen, and the film. My husband actually drew them, and then the monument maker was able to inscribe them into the stone. And then the expression, "All the world's a stage."
Leff says, in Jewish tradition, families hold a monument unveiling ceremony 1 year after a loved one has passed.
When I first saw it, I knew, that's it. That's what I wanted. That's what Dad would want. That's what they would want.
Memorials vary across culture and also time. Recent trends include environmentally friendly headstones made of plant materials and interactive stones that link visitors to a website. While memorials continue to evolve, the impulse to honor and cherish a loved one remains everlasting. In Colma, I'm Melanie Young for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
G, giving, garlic in our garden. A, acceptance, aromatic garlic aioli. R, relaxed, roasted garlic. L,
we asked you what that was and where you think we recorded it. We sent KALW's Emma Nobel, our visiting journalist from New Zealand, to the Gilroy Garlic Festival to bring us the story.
Garlic put Gilroy on the map. Today, it calls itself the garlic capital of America. But that wasn't always the case. First, the town grew hay and grain. Then it was home to the largest cigar manufacturing plant in the United States. After the First World War, Jimmy Hirasaki and other Japanese-American farmers began growing garlic commercially here. With its cold winters, hot summers, and fertile ground, Gilroy's the ideal environment for growing garlic.
Garlic, everybody asks about garlic, and garlic is really a bulb crop. It comes from the lily family.
This is Brian Jones. He knows a lot about garlic.
My occupation is I grow garlic seed for Old Lamb Spices and Vegetables, the people that own the old Gilroy Foods garlic plant just down the road.
Jones says there's less garlic coming out of Gilroy than there used to be. Christopher Ranch, the country's largest garlic packer, is making a third less garlic than it did around a decade ago. And they're not the only ones.
California does not produce as much garlic as they once did because China took over that low-end consumer demand. We still have our markets for garlic because California garlic has a stronger pungency to it.
In Gilroy, where garlic is the town's lifeblood, it's scary to think what less of the crop could mean for the town's future. And it's not just cheap Chinese imports that are endangering Gilroy's garlic supply. California's mostly semi-arid desert, and that's a problem for water-loving crops like garlic. So, as it's gotten drier, water conservation has become an important part of garlic growers' operations.
In farming garlic, we're now moving into highly concentrated forms of irrigation, principally drip irrigation, whereby instead of flooding a field like they did in Egypt in the Nile Valley, it is now run through a garden hose, so to speak, with emitters every 8 or 10 inches. And thereby you reduce the required amount of water for garlic or any other crop by as much as 50 to 75%. And that's what's required in the thirsty world.
The truth is, Gilroy needs garlic like garlic needs water. It's the town's biggest industry. Profits from the annual garlic festival, over $2 million this year, go towards local community groups and charities. The Gilroy Gators swim team, Boy Scouts, and Hope Rehabilitation, which teaches disabled people to work. But it's more than that.
It's a homecoming time for those who have moved away. And they come back and they see friends that they haven't seen for a while. It's like a family reunion or a high school reunion or something to that effect.
That's Jerry Foisey.
And my alias here at the Garlic Festival is Mr. Garlic.
Mr. Garlic is dressed as a giant garlic bulb. His straw sun hat is covered with garlics and purple flowers. He's the festival's unofficial ambassador, gives directions, poses for photos, and he says garlic is important for Gilroy's continued livelihood.
The importance of it is number one, it's one of the number one products produced and processed in the Gilroy area. The farmers themselves that grow the garlic, and then there's those who process it. You're talking about from the dirt to the cloves that you get in the jar. So it's a very, very big item, and it's a very big industry for us.
The crowning clove in the festival's bulb is the garlic wedding.
It is because of these factors and our desire to recommit to sharing a lifetime of loving garlic together that we wish to renew our vows with loved ones at the 2015 Gilroy Garlic Festival. What better way to honor that than during the same weekend that our marriage began?
Tom and Stacey Davenport won a social media competition to score their wedding redo. It's one of the big draws at the festival. The stands are packed. The bride and groom are Gilroy natives. They went to Gilroy High and they got married on Garlic Festival weekend in 1996.
People ask how we have navigated this journey and we answer, with garlic, of course. G, giving, garlic in our garden. A, acceptance, aromatic garlic aioli. R, relaxed, roasted garlic. L, love, loaves of garlic bread. I, independence, infused garlic ice cream. C, commitment, crushed garlic. It is because of these.
Stacey Davenport, the bride, is wearing a white sundress and she's really sticking to the theme, down to the miniature garlic bulb earrings dangling from her ears.
The bouquet and the headdress are both made out of garlic. There is eucalyptus and rosemary, and it's highlighted with a deep purple flower as well as a deep purple ribbon that matches the Gilroy Garlic Association t-shirts that you'll see.
Gilroy's certainly caught garlic fever. A clove of the stuff is a one-stop shop for fighting off Dracula, unwanted kisses, and the common cold.
If you're one of those people concerned about germs, you could drop one or two in your pants.
No doubt it's good for that too. For Cross Currents, I'm Emma Nobel.
With psyllium, germanium, allicin too.
Our winner this week is Kenneth Shagwa. Congratulations! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, you'll have another chance to win next week. Here's your sneak listen.
And but I do want to tell you one more time that the fireworks and the laser show will start sharp at 8 o'clock.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We'll tell you the story behind the sound next Thursday on Cross Currents. To find out more, head to our website, kalw.org, click on Audiograph. Thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, we want to know about them. Email us at news@kalw.org. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And speaking of John Santos, this Sunday is his 60th birthday, and the SF Jazz Center is celebrating with a special program featuring lots of special guests and the birthday boy himself. That's this Sunday in the Minor Auditorium of the SF Jazz Center. Music begins at 8 p.m. Feliz cumpleaños! For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.